So, hi, thank you. And thank you for inviting me also to this amazing space and to this amazing series. I wanted to just start by saying I'm a member of the Globe's editorial board. One of the things that we do periodically is decide which candidates to endorse for election. Some candidates might think it's not such a great thing in the end to get our endorsement, but we do it anyway. And one of the things that we always look for when we're looking for the profile of someone who should represent Massachusetts in Congress is, first of all, someone who understands the state and the district, someone who understands how to use the levers of government to get things done, and then someone who has an agenda and something to work for, goals to achieve, goals to strive for, and a willingness to continue Massachusetts' tradition of having, you know, a real set of national leaders, people who help the state punch out of its weight class when it comes to national influence and changing the country. And I think there are a few members of Congress who exemplify that more than Congressman Frank. You know, he's combined his heartfelt interest in a lot of issues, from obviously LGBT rights to low-income housing and helping the poor, with a chess player's approach to Congress and to congressional dealings, a skill with rhetoric, a sense of humor. I think that if there were more stand-up comics in Congress, honestly, we would have dealt with a lot more major issues a lot more effectively. I'm serious about that, but in the absence of that, we've had Congressman Frank, who has at the very least fulfilled the reporter's need for getting a quotable quote all the time. His greatest hits are in his book, which are going to be on sale after this. It also tells an amazing story of a life in politics and an amazing amount of change. You know, most of it very good, some of it not so good, that's happened over the course of a 42-year career?
45.
So thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start, the last time we talked was in 2012. You were still in Congress, you had announced your retirement, and you were planning your wedding. And you were talking about how a big problem you had was that too many members of Congress were inviting themselves to your wedding, and you couldn't invite the president because it would have been a traffic nightmare in Newton.
Yes.
How's married life?
It's excellent. No, that is true. I mean, obviously when I started, even well into my congressional career in the early part of this century, the notion that I could get married to Jim, who's sitting back here, that you know, falling in love, yeah, I hoped for that, but being able to marry, I never thought that would be possible as a sitting member of Congress, just in terms of the uproar. And instead, as you said accurately, it did become controversial because people wanted to be invited and couldn't come. But I do have to add one part of that, and it's a sad fact that continues, it was partisan. The enthusiasm for interest in attending was entirely on the Democratic side. I did have one Republican colleague who I had worked with because of our positions, and Jim and his wife had gotten friendly because the spouses are often thrown together, and he asked for an invitation, and we sent him an invitation, and he didn't show up, and we never heard from him. I came back to my office one day, and there was a very nice hammered out picture frame that had been given to us as a wedding present after the announcement from a Republican member of Congress. And I was very happy, called Jim, described it. It was a woman member. And then I just said, let me check again. And of course, she had voted just for a reiteration of the Defense of Marriage Act, that is to make the wedding illegal. So I called her, she wasn't there, and I went over to her office and returned the gift. And
was she there? Did she?
No, she was not there, but she then called me and said, well, what's the matter? I said, well, I don't want to give her name. I said, it was lovely, but you just voted that I shouldn't be able to get married. I don't want to accept a present from someone who wants to make my marriage illegal. And it was interesting. She said, oh, well, you know, I was just afraid of my primary. And she wasn't indignant. She clearly felt guilty. And I said, I don't, you know, want to be offensive, but, you know, think about it. She said, yeah, I was a coward. And a few months later, she resigned from Congress, took a job with an association. And she was one of those, and this is a sad fact of American political life, she was sort of a moderate to conservative Republican who found it impossible to stay in the party. I mean, we used to have in Massachusetts people like Senator Ed Brooke and former Governor Frank Sargent. People will remember that. People here probably voted Republican from time to time, say for Frank Hatch or somebody else, and they're almost all gone. They've been driven out. So that was the sad part. But it's, but for me, you know, married life has been very nice.
And now, you know, marriage equality, gay marriage is legal in what, 36 states and the District of Columbia. The Supreme Court is very quickly going to rule on.
Yeah, and Ireland. I mean, I have to say, I think we are on the verge of complete victory, and I give two indications. For a long time, we've been making this fight. I filed the first gay rights bill, as we then called it, in Massachusetts history, and it was one of the first in any state. There were two or three others around in 1972, when I was first elected to Congress, supported by a group of people who were pioneers, including, I don't see her, but maybe people will know, Anne McGuire. And Anne was one of those who was a leader in this effort. There were two organizations. There was the Homophile Union of Boston, which was the men, and the Daughters of Bilitis, which was the women. I for a long time, had no idea who Bilitis was. I'm told she was Sappho's lover. That's at least the story I got. But, you know, in at that time, obviously, we hadn't gotten very far. Over time, we've made great progress, I believe, largely because we stopped hiding. I mean, we coming out was the fundamental reason, and people saw that our reality greatly differed from the stereotype, and people also learned that they had friends, teachers, co-workers, teammates, doctors, patients who were gay and lesbian. I mean, I think that's the reason that we have made, well, not legally, but attitudinally, more progress in fighting homophobia than in racial prejudice. I wish I was as optimistic about that, but it's largely because African Americans don't have white relatives the way gay and lesbian people have straight relatives, and that kinship played a major role. But two factors have now come to bear that make me think we're going to win fairly soon, pretty decisively. As I said, for a long time, in addition to coming out, we had morality on our side. We had the people who were opposed to unfairness, the people who didn't like discrimination. Then came Indiana. And in Indiana, you remember, people wanted to have the legal right for people to discriminate against us on religious grounds. And the business community said, please don't do that. And yes, it's nice to have morality on your side, but when the profit motive arrives, it's kind of like...
That's like Walmart was one of the big opponents,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. The profit motive, if this were a movie, if this was some cheesy Western where the Indians were being shot for trying to defend their own land, the business community would be the cavalry that arrived at the critical moment. And what they basically said was, it's very interesting, look, your prejudice is getting in the way of our making money. So take it and get the hell out of our way if you want to be prejudiced. And one of the things I learned, basically, the bigots were saying to the business community, we're going to do you this favor. We're going to let you discriminate against people who were gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender. And the business community said, no, thank you. Because if we do that, if we have that right, either we will get people mad because we discriminate against them, or we'll get other people mad because we don't discriminate against them. And it happened with Walmart, and it just happened in Louisiana, where the governor sent in a bill to do this, and the Convention Bureau got everybody in the legislative committee to vote against it. And this is a corollary of something I learned early on. Don't do favors for people who haven't asked you to do the favor. You get into trouble. And I learned that in one of my earliest, maybe my first or second year, a woman called to complain that her daughter's fiance, who was in the military, was about to be sent overseas before the wedding. And could I intervene? So I did. I was new and didn't realize that. I called the Army. They, two things. At first they said, well, we understand, Congressman, but you realize under privacy, we can't discuss this with you. He would have to call. And he did call. He called me, because he was then asked, you know, about it. He called my office and said, will you mind your own goddamn business? Because he was very happy to be sent overseas before the wedding. And I learned You don't ask people, you don't do people favors unasked. And that's, so that was the, I mean, and I think it's clear that the business community has done this. And the other one, of course, was that extraordinary referendum in Ireland. Ireland, which had probably of all the societies in the world, where the Catholic Church has historically had the greatest influence. And in this case, one, the Catholic Church downplayed it, and they didn't make as big a deal. And secondly, overwhelming victory. So I think we are on the verge of winning. I expect the Supreme Court to decide that marriage is okay. But then again, on the other side, that will leave one important agenda item, because it is still legal in most states, although not in the largest share of the population, to refuse to hire someone or to fire someone or not promote someone because she's gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And it will take a federal statute to do that. And we're now at the point, and again, I have to keep stressing it, it's a partisan point. The next time you have a Democratic president, House, and Senate, we will get a national law that bans that kind of discrimination. But as long as the Republicans control any one of those, it is very unlikely.
You wrote in your book about ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and also the historic difficulty with getting transgender people into that bill. Given, again, what you just said about how important it was socially for people to come out, how much, given this last week, is Caitlyn Jenner going to come in?
Caitlyn Jenner is really kind of the proof that it's over. It is true. But what happens in 1972, when things speed up sometimes, in 72, when I introduced a bill for what we then called gay rights, but it was to end discrimination based on sexual orientation, frankly, nobody was thinking much about transgender then, including our own community. What I encountered was what they call the kind of ick factor. I was closeted at the time, and actually, because I was closeted, I got elected. I made a very important set of decisions when I got elected. First of all, I would be a coward in one sense. I would not have the courage to tell people that I was gay, but I would never be a hypocrite. I literally had this conversation with myself, fortunately, silently. I didn't get in the pre-cell phone era, you didn't want to be mumbling aloud, but I said I would never be a hypocrite, that I would, from the day I got elected, be an advocate for LGBT rights. And the spectacle of people who are themselves gay or lesbian supporting efforts to persecute others is outrageous. And I should correct myself. I said gay or lesbian. In this case, I can safely say gay, because I don't know any lesbians who do that. I mean, the hypocrites are all gay men. They're all Republican gay men, a couple of Democrats. But I said I would sponsor. So these two groups I mentioned, the Homophile Union and Daughters of Bilitis, circulated a questionnaire to everybody running for the legislature in 1972, which was just after Stonewall. So there was, they said, would you support a bill to prevent discrimination and repeal the sodomy law, which we still have in the books? And secondly, would you be a sponsor of such a bill, a sponsor? So apparently several people said they would support the law. But I was the only one who agreed to be a sponsor. So while I had said, here's what, I'll be a supporter, but you know, being a 32-year-old unmarried man, I'm gay, probably not a good idea for me to be the lead sponsor. But fortunately, I'm a freshman, there'll be senior members who want to do that. I was the only one who said yes. So by process of elimination, I became the leader of the gay rights movement because I was the only one who said I would sponsor the bill. But as I went around, I had people say to me, and they didn't know I was gay, you know, pal, I got nothing against those people. Hey, you know, they should live their own lives. But I'm afraid to vote that way, or you know, I don't want to take the heat. And then others would say, oh, I don't know, it made them uncomfortable. I mean, you would talk to people about gay and lesbian people, oh, no, and some of them would be openly, oh, I'm not going to hire some dyke, et cetera. But what I got was in 72, people were just, they were made very uncomfortable by the notion of gay and lesbian people and gay and lesbian physical intimacy. That eroded over time as we came out. But the transgender issue had not been out. Transgender people were not out as much. So in 2007, which was the first time since 2000 that we had a Democratic House, Senate, President, we were ready to go and we had a bill to end discrimination. And we found, to our dismay, the original bill would have covered everybody. that we did not have the votes to include transgender people fully. They were going to offer amendments about teachers and things. So it was somewhat controversial. We did go ahead. Nancy Pelosi decided, I thought she was, we were right, that we would go ahead with the lesbian, gay, and bisexual part. And it did pass the House. It didn't pass the Senate. It was, with Bush as president, wasn't going to go anywhere. 2 years later, when we had a Democratic president, House and Senate, there was still uneasiness over the transgender issue. So that, in those 2 years, taking advantage of the Democratic control, we passed the Transgender Inclusive Hate Crimes Amendment, and we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was tough. But we put off the anti-discrimination until the next year, and then the Republicans took power in the House, and we couldn't do it. But the point is that by now, we're over that. The progress we had made between 72 and sort of 2000 in getting people comfortable with the idea of gays and lesbians, that's now happened with the transgender community.
Do you think it's done? I mean, I've seen mostly an amazing, including in the media, which I think has always been a very respectful of people's coming out process, and maybe you can tell the story of your own coming out, which is a great story, but coming out to the globe, I mean, and hence the wider world. But there's been, I think, an incredible respect given to Caitlyn Jenner, which is perhaps a sign of what you're saying.
Yeah, well, it is a sign, although, by the way, even in Massachusetts passed a bill banning discrimination based on sexual orientation in 1989. It was one of the last bills that Michael Dukakis signed. But they have still not been able to broaden it to include people with transgender, and it's stuck on an issue people
with. It keeps being called the bathroom bill, right?
Yeah, it was called the bathroom bill by Charlie Baker when he ran for governor, even though he had a gay running mate who could not dissuade him from saying that, Richard Tsai back then. And the argument is not so much, it's not just bathrooms. I've had to deal with this. With regard to bathrooms, I mean, bathrooms, you can have privacy. I've said, when people raise that, I see, did anybody grow up in a house with a men's room and a women's room? I mean, I think, we all grew up with unisex bathrooms, so that shouldn't be so shocking. The problem, frankly, are communal showers. I mean, this is the issue. What do you do about gyms or other places where there are communal showers, and do you have shower stalls? And I think that would be the one small compromise, but they haven't been able to get the bill through the Massachusetts legislature without some degree of compromise. The transgender community has said no. Other people have done it. I believe the next time you have the requisite Democratic control in the Congress, there will be one with some provision for some privacy in communal showers. That would be the only thing. Other than that, yeah, that barrier has been broken. Yeah, my coming out, very interesting. Still somewhat the case with the media. It was the rule with the media that they would not out someone as gay or lesbian, even if they knew that person was gay or lesbian, unless a news story broke in which sexuality was a part of it. Well, what that meant, sadly, was they only outed people when something bad had happened. They'd been involved in a sexual tinted scandal, or they had AIDS. And otherwise, they respected the privacy. Now, in one sense, that was a service to our privacy, but it reflected this view that being gay or lesbian was so terrible that you could never mention it in general, unlike almost anything else. It's the only, they would not keep any other aspect quiet. Anyway, in the 80s, I finally decided I was ready to acknowledge being gay, but I was afraid, this is the 80s, AIDS had now was unfortunately in full frequency. So I said, all right, I'm going to come out, have another one of these internal monologues, but I want to minimize it. The strategy was I would acknowledge being gay, but I would say that it wasn't a big deal. Well, in fact, if your sexuality is not a big deal, you have my sympathy. I mean, in fact, and most of us would like to. It's a very important part of personality. But I wanted to be able to say it's not a big deal. By then I was not hiding it as much. So it was fairly widely known among insiders that I was gay. In fact, in 1986, one of those hypocritical Republicans, a man named Robert Bauman, who had voted for all the anti-gay legislation. He was also, incidentally, the leading anti-abortion member of Congress. And he was criminally convicted for having sex with 15-year-old boys. He picked up a kid in a strip bar and drove off with his congressional license plates, and the kid's boyfriend reported him to the police. And anyway, he was very angry that I seemed to be getting away with it. He lost his seat because of it, but again, the hypocrisy was a big part of it, and the underage factor. So he wrote a book in which he kind of hinted at my being gay. So at that point, this was the first stage of the coming out, I approached Tip O'Neill on the Fourth House, who was very supportive. In fact, in 1979, when there was the first gay march in Washington, I was still in the legislature. I was not ready to go appear at the march. I was still closeted, but I was out to friends and fellow and sister gay and lesbian people and my siblings. And I rounded up every Irish gay and lesbian person I could who lived in Tip O'Neill's district and said, okay, now we had a dress code, suits and dresses, suits for the men, dresses for the women. And I don't understand this, you know, when you're trying to get something important to you, why would you not willingly concede on the unimportant things that would get in the way? Why would you not have priorities? I mean, the right to dress the way you want every minute of the day would seem to me less important than the right to win legal protection, after which you can then dress however you want. So we went to meet Tip O'Neill, who was surprisingly favorable, and he said, you know what all the homosexuals should do? You should tell everybody you're homosexuals, because then they say they have a problem because you're all subjected to blackmail. So if you all told everybody who you were, you couldn't be blackmailed. People walked in and said, did the Speaker of the House just tell me I'm supposed to come out? Yeah, apparently he did. Anyway, and so he was always very supportive. In 86, though, I approached him to tell him what I said was, you know, a book's about to come out, and some of this is discussed in my book. There's a book about to come out from Bob Bauman that's going to hint that I'm gay. I said, oh, Bally, don't be paying any attention to that. They always spend shit about us. Who cares? I said, well, it's true, though. That's part of the issue. Eventually, he said, oh, he was sad. He told me he was sad because he thought that was going to end my career. And this was not an unreasonable thing. In fact, he then talked, and I'd gotten a little confused. I thought it was Chris Matthews, but Mike Barnicle, the journalist, said Tip and he were playing golf or something, and he said, Michael, I'm afraid our friend Barney Frank's all through in politics. So what's the problem? Well, he's going to come out of the room. but he was sad because of the it would have the impact. But then I decided, okay, it was the next year I was ready. I didn't want to come out in the context of a book about a guy who had this seamy sex with underage kids and who had been beaten up because of the kind of things he was doing. So the next year I decided finally, in fact, what then happened was journalists would ask me if they could write about it. This is interesting. And I would say, no, I'm not ready. And that was the rule at the time, that you did not initiate it. And one day, one of the major figures in Massachusetts history, not just journalistic history, Bob Healy. I mean, the Boston Globe, for a while, was edited by a towering figure, a guy named Tom Winship, who just was a tremendous factor and really made the Globe into the kind of important paper that it became. And Bob Healy was kind of his right-hand man, his political chief. He, in fact, he played a political role as well as a journalistic role. When it looked like a group connected, I think, to the Boston Herald, Traveler as it then was going to be able to buy Channel 5. The Globe was afraid of the competitive disadvantage, and they worked hard, and Healy came up with some dirt on the people and got to the FCC, and they weren't able to buy it. But he came down to see me in my office. He said, I got to talk to you about that. Bob was a good guy and no prejudice, but he was, you know, at that point, maybe 60 and grown up in a good Irish Catholic atmosphere, and he was uneasy about it. He said, I got to talk about you know. I said, oh, we're going to talk about my you know. Yeah. And basically what he said was, The Globe wanted me to, they wanted to write about my being gay, because not that they had some need to invade my privacy, but they were afraid somebody else was going to write about it because it was in the conversation. And they were the leading paper in New England and in my district, and for them to be scooped, understood that would be a problem for them. And so, you know, they knew this, for them to be scooped because they were respecting my privacy was a problem. So I said, well, I'm not ready to come out, but here's what I'll do. As you know, no one is going to write that story about me without first calling me. This is pre-internet days. We're talking about, you know, the procedure of an article, et cetera. I said, you give me your personal number. Probably wasn't a cell phone number in 1986. Give me the way to get, you know, I'll call the paper, an emergency, they'll know how to reach you. And if someone calls me to get me to comment on a story that's outing me, I will call you right away. So the goal will at least tie, and I'll give you the better story. That was acceptable. Nobody asked me. And finally, I decided the time had come. So I called the Globe and I said, I'm ready. And they said, good, send us your statement. And I said, no, I don't have a statement. I will respond if you ask me. They said, oh, we can't ask you. That's you know, our rule is we never ask. I said, well, I'm not going to send you a statement because I want to argue that my being gay is no big deal. Well, how can I, if it's no big deal, why would I announce it? You know, I can't say to people, you know, well, why did you, you know, have a press conference to make something public? You don't think it's important. So I said, you got to ask me. And they didn't want to ask me. And this went on for a while. And finally, they got worried and said, okay, we're going to ask you. Then there were some internal problems at the Globe. The Globe's congressional reporter was a gay man named John Robinson, who had issues with his own sexuality, and it seemed to be one of the areas I did criticize the Globe. He later became the Globe's kind of gossip columnist, where he was still closeted and would write snarky stuff about other gay people. But they said, okay, and they sent a reporter named Kay Longcope down to see me. Now, Kay was the only out lesbian on the paper, and I had met Kay when she was the lover of Elaine Noble. Elaine Noble, who does not get appropriate historical mention, she, rather than Harvey Milk, was the first person to get elected to public office who was open about her being homosexual. She was elected in 1974 from a district in the Back Bay of Boston. It went from Gloucester Street out to the Fenway. And so I didn't know Kay. So Kay came down and prearranged, put a tape recorder in front of me, and said, okay, we're ready to go. Congressman, are you gay? And I gave the answer I had carefully thought about. I don't always think before I do these things, but I mean, in terms of the wording. And my answer was, yeah, so what? And it was kind of hard to put out a statement that said, I'm gay, so what? You know? But it was a good answer to a question. So that was how, and then the response was way much better than I thought it would be. I have to say that it was, It was a very, in fact, that Saturday, the Globe, they did cross me up a little. I thought the story was going to run Monday. They didn't think it would hold, so they ran on a Saturday, which was a Memorial Day weekend. And that Saturday night, there was a performance at the Bank of America Amphitheater down on the waterfront. And I think the Cirque du Soleil was in town. And Christopher Reeve was in town before his terrible accident. And this is a show business crowd, and he was introduced and got very nice applause. And then I was introduced. Well, I just come out that day. And so the applause was, I don't know if you ever read the transcripts of Soviet Union official Communist Party meetings, but they would say, you know, applause in parentheses, prolonged stormy applause, all rise. So I and this show business audience, a politician, gets about five times as loud an ovation as he did. I'm sure he was unclear as to what had happened. But the response was very nice.
So I was going to bring this up later, ask this later, but since you did mention hypocrisy, another event in the news this week is the Denny Hastert scandal. And as someone who has weathered scandals, has advised presidents and helped, you know, a president weather a scandal, what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, I was totally surprised. I mean, I'm, you know, being gay and being in Congress, knowing people, I never heard the slightest hint of anything about acid. Most of the people who were closeted, who later were identified as gay, I was not surprised. Democrat or Republican, you know, you hear things. Never heard anything about Hastert. Second thing is, I think you have to separate this out. There were two levels of hypocrisy here. First of all, a man who was not denied having had sex with, and nobody was surprised, I'm sure, that other people came forward. I mean, they said he had sex with this one student. Do you think there were others? Do you know anybody who has only had sex once in his life or her life? I mean, that would be. So he began his speakership by presiding over the vote in the U.S. House to impeach Bill Clinton for having had sex with someone who had been an intern. I mean, the hypocrisy of that, and remember, they kept stressing the relationship. He wasn't a supervisor at the time. It wasn't any of his coach. He was older. In fact, he was the third choice to be the speaker. The first was Newt Gingrich, who had to quit because he was, at that point, having an affair with his soon-to-be third wife while married to his second wife, with whom he had had an affair while his first wife was was very ill with cancer. And the third wife with whom he was having the affair, he had had the chairman of the Agriculture Committee of the House hire her. So she was on the payroll, thanks to him, when they were having the affair. The second, he was to be replaced by Bob Livingston from Louisiana, who had to step aside because it turned out not simply that he was having an extramarital affair, but he was having the affair with a woman who was a lobbyist who was lobbying him on issues. So again, this is more than just the sexual issue. And then comes Hastert.
Who was the squeaky clean guy.
The third. Hastert was fairly obscure, but the real power, the majority leader of the House at the time, ordinarily when the Speaker leaves, the majority leader steps up, but it was a man named Dick Armey, who was a fool. And by that time, the Republicans had elected him in 95, and they didn't know him that well. One of the first things, some of you may remember, he did after becoming the majority leader was to say he wasn't going to write a book. Gingrich, when he became Speaker, was given a $5 million advance by Rupert Murdoch's publishing house to write a book, obviously a significant bribe. That changed the rules, so sitting members of Congress can't get advances anymore. You can only get the royalties. And they asked Armey if he was going to write a book, and he said, no, I don't need Barney Fagg criticizing me for writing a book. I actually hadn't said anything. I was just on his mind. He, unfortunately, him said it on tape. And so people then said, Barney Fagg, but he said, oh, no, as the times had changed, he knew that was not a good thing to have been recorded saying. So he explained that he had meant to say Barney Frank, and he had simply mispronounced the name. At which point, my brother, who's a very skillful political writer, he worked in my campaigns, he called me, he said, let's talk to Mother. So we talked to my mother, and she agreed to be quoted as saying, the question was this a mispronunciation of Frank, or did he mean to call me a fag? And she said, in the 59 years since she had married my father, no one had ever called her Elsie Fag. So she thought that was pretty good proof that this was his name. But he was a fool, so they had to bypass him. The real power in the House at the time was a man named Tom DeLay. But he was smart enough to know that he was way too controversial. Many of the people around him were later sent to prison for lobbying. He was indicted, but the conviction was overturned over some election campaign spending stuff. So he, as the real power, got Hastert and put Hastert in the speakership so that he could exercise the real power. But that was the one hypocrisy. The other is, and I've said, look, let's be very clear, man, the fact that it was male-to-male sex obviously should not be considered any kind of a problem. There is the problem of the teacher-student relationship. But the other factor is, even if it hadn't been there, this is a man who twice put before the House of Representatives as Speaker a constitutional amendment that George Bush was pushing, which not only would have prevented future same-sex marriages, but in its terms, this is by now 2004 and then 2006, it would have retroactively canceled the marriages that we had had in Massachusetts. because the federal constitution would trump anything. And it said, not going forward, no marriage shall be valid unless it's between a man and a woman. Now, sometimes you can say, well, he was in the spot, you know, the issue came up, he had to vote for it. No, he was the speaker. It was his decision to put those two constitutional amendments before the House. So for someone who is having gay sex himself, to do that is the kind of hypocrisy which leaves me devoid of any sympathy for him.
I want to move on to some other issues and talk about the financial sector and the work that you've done. You were instrumental in the passage of TARP. You were the chairman of the Financial Services Committee. You were instrumental in putting the reins on the industry with the Dodd-Frank Act. Income inequality has not changed. If anything, it's worsened. I feel like every week there's a new story that comes out about executive compensation and how out of sync it is, how the orders of magnitude higher than the average worker these executives make. Is that issue, is there anything that Congress can do on that issue alone? Is it really merely a symbolic issue or because of the
incentives? No, there are things we can do, not just in the financial industry. I mean, there were two compensation issues that we attached. First of all, we did put into the law what we borrowed explicitly from the British, which is called say on pay, so that shareholders get to vote on the executive compensation. It's advisory, but if they vote no, it's unlikely for it to be ignored. And in fact, there was a negative shareholder vote on the compensation of Vikram Pandit, who was the CEO of Citicorp, that led to his being thrown out. And I was just pleased to see with regard to J.P. Morgan Chase that something like 39% of the shareholders voted against the compensation of Jamie Dimon. That'll constrain him in the future. On the other hand, most of the shares are held by mutual funds and others, and they vote with the company because they have a kind of a symbiotic relationship with the company. And frankly also, we realize this, their own CEOs are getting that kind of pay. They're not going to vote against paying other people. The one thing we did do that the regulators haven't yet fully acted on, there were two problems with the compensation. One was the level. Secondly, though, and that was true throughout industry, and we only had jurisdiction over the financial sector. Beyond that, though, it was the structure of the compensation, whereby you would get a bonus if a particular decision made a lot of money for the company. The problem was, if that particular decision lost money for the company, you broke even. It was a one-way deal. So it was not heads I win, tails you lose, but heads I win, tails I break even. Well, if I tell you that if you make a series of bets, and if you are successful, you will make money, and if you're not successful, nothing happens, you're going to make a lot of bets. So we have instructed the regulators to change compensation, essentially to say it's got to be a two-way street in the first place. Secondly, where it does pay off, they got to wait. And some of these deals would look good right away, and a year or two later, it wouldn't look so good. So some of this, you can pay them off in stock, but it has to wait 2 years before it fully vests. Beyond that, though, inequality really, we didn't have that jurisdiction. I'd say two things. The first thing to do is simply to tax it more heavily, because it's not just financial people. I mean, when people are making, even if you said, okay, if you're earning more than $1 million a year, not if you have a million net worth, but if you're earning more than a million or even 2 million a year, yeah, I would subject that to a very heavy tax, and I do not believe that would be much of a disincentive. In fact, that was part of it. These guys would give themselves these big bonuses, and we had one hearing where all the CEOs of the 9 biggest financial institutions were there, and I said, I want to ask you a question. If you weren't getting that bonus, would you work less hard? Would you not help? Oh, of course not. We do everything we can. I said, well, let me be your consultants. Save money for the company. Don't pay yourself a bonus if the company's not getting anything from it. But the other things to do about inequality go beyond that. I mean, one of the things that I hope people will, and I think some liberals forgot about this, it is now clear that the erosion in the role of labor unions has been a significant factor in the inequality. It turns out unions have been helpful. And let me give you an example that the low-wage policy is not just inexorable law of economic nature. In the state of Tennessee, Volkswagen opens a plant in Chattanooga. Volkswagen has had very good relationships with its worker councils in Germany. So they said to the United Auto Workers, we would like to have a union because we found that to be helpful. So the UAW petitions to have an election for to be the union representative for the workers at the Volkswagen plant. And the company says yes. At that point, Senator Bob Corker, who's supposedly a mainstream conservative, he fights for some of the Tea Party people, on behalf of other Tennessee Republicans, says to Volkswagen, if you wind up with a union, we are going to rescind an offer we have made of public money to help you expand the factory. By the way, from the conservative standpoint, this is the use of public money to the private corporation. But they were going to give some deal for Volkswagen, maybe tax abatements and others, so they could expand. And if you go ahead with the union, we're not going to give you the money. Even with that, the union lost the election, but by a fairly small number. Clearly, they would have won without that threat. And Corker was asked, well, why would you object if the company wants to have the union? Why were you objecting? He said, very revealing, here's the problem. If the union gets recognized at Volkswagen, that will increase the wages of Volkswagen workers. Now, that's important because in their attacks on unions, people like Governor Walker have said, oh, you're paying that union for nothing. They don't have any effect on wages. So it was an acknowledgement that unions can help wages. But here's the key part. If wages go up, the answer would be, well, Volkswagen's money. What do you care? If wages go up at the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee, that will put upward pressure on wages elsewhere in Tennessee. And if wages tend to go up in Tennessee, we will lose our ability to attract industry from other states. We will lose our ability to go to Massachusetts or Michigan or somewhere else and say, why don't you bring your factory here, you can pay them less. So this wage suppression is a conscious choice. There are other things we can do with the minimum wage, and we can, I believe we should extend Medicare downward to 55. Medicare takes a lot of pressure off people. It works very well. You could put through what the president talked about facilitating people going to get higher education. The problem is some of these things, not the union thing, but some of these things cost money. You could, one thing right away to help was have a massive program of construction of highways, yes, fix the bridges, expand public transportation. And 40 years ago, that would have meant white guys. But today, the construction industry includes women. It includes minorities. You could put people to work at pretty good wages, and it also helps the economy, et cetera. The problem is there was this financial shortfall. So I believe if we suddenly had $100 billion at the federal level freed up, you could do a number of things that would increase, diminish inequality. By the way, New York Times had a very good article a couple weeks ago about how the cutback in public employment has had a particularly negative effect on African Americans because the government has been less prejudiced than others. So put construction workers back to work, increase some of the public spending, let people get to colleges, raise the minimum wage, support unions. The problem is some of these things cost money, and the answer that I say in the book is it's a strong argument for substantially reducing our worldwide military expenditures, much of which are not doing any good anyway. If we had not gone to war in Iraq, we would have had well over $1 trillion that we could have spent on many of these things. And the other, I believe, is the conservatives have talked about how the war on poverty was a failure. The war on poverty was a smashing success compared to the war on drugs, which has disorganized society, cost a great deal of money. So if we freed up that money, then we could do this.
Really quickly, outside of labor union organizing, I've been curious what you think of activism on that front. This was a couple years ago now that the Occupy movement gained a lot of attention briefly. You're very critical in your book of people who work outside the system and who sort of ask for all or nothing and don't work incrementally, and B, reject the system as a means of...
It is possible to put pressure on private companies. Mm-hmm. There's no question that the agitation... Walmart got sort of shamed into raising some of those low wages, but Walmart made this terrible mistake of sending out, Walmart sent out to its employees instructions on how to get food stamps. Well, they made themselves pretty vulnerable.
One of those companies also, I think, put out a collection basket
For their workers. So go back to the AIDS fight. They embarrassed some of the drug companies. So activism that protests and tries to embarrass private companies works. Trying to embarrass politicians by demonstrations and criticism rarely works, especially since many of the people that try to embarrass get votes from the people who don't like the people trying to embarrass them. So every time AIDS activists picketed or in other ways demonstrated against Jesse Helms, he sent out a fundraising letter saying, they're after me again, and he made a lot of money. You can't do that with politicians respond to vote pressures. And you mentioned Occupy, and that's a very, I'm glad you did. It's a very good example. We had two movements at around the same time, Occupy talking about diminished inequality and the Tea Party. The Tea Party got involved in taking over the Republican Party. They registered their people to vote, they voted in primaries, and they took over the Republican Party. Occupy had drum circles. Turns out voting in primaries is a much more effective way to change public policy than drum circles. I was on the Bill Maher show with a woman from Occupy, and I said, look, one of my problems is that I've never seen a voter registration table at an Occupy site. Well, that's not what we're into. So yeah, I do think there has been this tendency on the part of some of the left to engage in emotive activity. And part of it's because it's, oh, if we start registering voting, we're implicitly condoning the political system. Well, you can be for all the change you want, but ignoring it doesn't work. And the final point I would make on this, I mean, so the fact is the Tea Party had a lot of impact. The Occupy had none because of this choice of demonstrations versus political participation. And people said, well, we're militant, so we don't get involved in this, you know, lobbying and political stuff. Militancy means demonstrations. I think the most successfully militant political organization in America, given the amount of support they have, is the National Rifle Association. Have you ever seen an NRA? They don't have shoot-ins or march-ins or I will tell you how they work. Everybody there registers to vote, and then they monitor the process. And if a bill is coming up in the city council or a state legislature or in the Congress, every member of that legislative body hears from the gun people in his or her district, don't vote for this. And they are a very effective employer of their political clout. And yeah, that's the big difference.
So before we get to audience questions, because we have a few, I did want to ask you if you could handicap the 2016 presidential race.
Well, it's easy. I think Hillary Clinton will be the nominee, and I am happy about that. I have to say to some of my friends on the left, and Bernie Sanders is a guy I worked with some, although I've lost one thing with Bernie's candidacy. I saw him the other day. I was going in to the place where they broadcast MSNBC in Washington, and Bernie was leaving. And his hair was very neatly combed. And I could always count on Bernie, so I was not the most disheveled member of Congress. And Bernie having now, but I don't think it'll last. But here's the deal about Bernie, and I admire him. He chose a very important role to be the agitator, the provocateur, the outsider, to say he was a socialist and rejected the Democratic Party. That's very important, but it doesn't translate well to winning the presidential election. And no, I do not want headline saying, oh, Hillary Clinton has moved closer to socialism. Socialism is a very honorable doctrine. Historically, it has never had, it's been a negative in America, that's just not helpful. People say, well, don't you want somebody, you know, don't you want people on the left sort of pressuring Hillary Clinton? Translated, don't you think we should do to ourselves in 2016 what the Republicans did to themselves in 2012? I mean, people understand that having people who are further off, that doesn't help us. We also have a money problem. And I don't want her, I want her to be able to save her money. So I believe she will be the nominee. On the Republican side, the one I fear the most is Scott Walker, because I think he has the fewest negatives. I would hope, and this is, you know, we've had problems with white working class guys. He's, the biggest item in his resume is his attack on unions, both public employee unions and then private union. In fact, he actually said, they got ridiculed out of this, that one argument for him, because he didn't know anything about foreign policy, but that he would be, he would have a much better record in getting the Iranians and the Russians to pay attention, because he has demonstrated his toughness with regard to unions. In other words, sort of, you know, beating up janitors will make the Iranians give up their nuclear weapons. So, but I, without that, I will
Jeb
say
Bush,
this.
Marco Rubio?
Jeb Bush has done much worse than I would have expected. He's just been an incompetent candidate. There is this sense that, you know, that Rubio would be their Obama. But I don't think the Republican Party is ready for quite that much difference. Having said all that, it's generally hard to say this far in advance who gets it. It does seem to me it's the others. I mean, the people like Rick Perry and Ted Cruz, there's no chance whatsoever. But I guess Walker, Bush, and Rubio are the if it's those are the three most possible. It could still be Bush with all that money. And the other thing you have to say is this. If 12 people are on the ballot somewhere, the winner of that is a lottery. I mean, a very small number of people, say in a caucus state, are going to decide who's first versus who's fourth. But the problem is that, frankly, people in your business will magnify the order of finish. So finishing first, even by 87 votes, will buy you a kind of lot of headlines. So that's the imponderable. That you have a kind of a random process almost with that many people in there, and out of that, it's unpredictable.
Well, it's momentum. There's this sort of reading of momentum and coming out.
But the press creates the momentum. But here's one other criticism I have of the press.
Bring it on.
The press says so and so is likely to win big, and so and so instead wins by less than expected, and so that's treated in the press almost as a loss. But they still won, and what that means is they're still stronger than anybody else. They're not quite as much stronger as other people. But somebody comes in first and beats, well, you had this in Iowa. It turned out that Rick Santorum won Iowa, but there was a miscount by about 100 votes. So he came in second, and people thought he'd come in second. They realized a little while later he'd come in first. That minuscule difference in votes took on much greater significance than it should have.
Fair enough. That's a fair criticism. Here's a question from the crowd, and if there are more, if anyone else has an envelope that they want to scribble on, we're happy to have it. During your times in Congress, what was the most important legislation that you helped pass?
Financial reform was the most important, and it wasn't everything I wanted, and there have been some problems, but I think it's made a fundamental shift. It's comparable importance to what was done in the New Deal, and yeah, I think that was probably the one that had the single most impact.
This is thematically similar and makes me think of Scott Walker. Many of the laws designated to protect workers have been deregulated, causing serious hardship for many. What are the chances of bringing some key ones back?
It's become, unfortunately, entirely partisan. And the chances are, if the Democrats win the presidency and win back the Senate and make gains in the House, there is a chance of doing some of it. But it's become very partisan. And on the Republican side, opposition to that is so strong it depends on if the Democrats win. Yeah, there will be, because there is this concern about inequality. But that's will be decided by the election.
You think paid leave as well initiative for paid leave is it falls into that category?
It will happen. Well, look, the story of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is not well understood. People blame Bill Clinton. It really wasn't his fault. He tried to repeal the ban on gays in the military in 1993. And at that point, the number one agenda item for the women's movement in America was family and medical leave, the ability to take off time, even unpaid, because you had family responsibilities. And while it's theoretically for both sexes, even more so then, but still today, that burden fell more on women than men. And the reason Bill Clinton had to back off, they said, why didn't he just do it with his own power? Because the Republicans had the votes in the Senate to amend the Family Medical Leave Act. The Family Medical Leave Act was the first bill the Democrats passed. Bill Clinton becomes president, and we have a Democratic House, Senate, and president. For the first time, since 1980 under Jimmy Carter. And it's been 12 years. And the number one priority of an important part of the movement, the women's movement, is family and medical leave. And the Senate is about to pass that bill. And Bob Dole, aided by Sam Nunn, who was a terrible bigot, leading Southern Democrat, announced that if that bill comes to the floor and Clinton is going to repeal the ban on gays serving in the military, they will add a statutory version of the ban to family and medical leave. And that's when Clinton had to back down, because it was very clever on that part. They pitted the LGBT movement against the women's movement. And so he said, okay, I'll defer on that. So they passed family and medical leave. And that was under the Democrats. When the Democrats had the House, Senate, and presidency, again, by the way, we didn't have that. This is part of my our problem. We get blamed for not delivering some. There has been a Democratic president, House, and Senate for exactly 4 years since 1980. The first 2 years of Bill Clinton, the first 2 years of Barack Obama. And we did pass what was called the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Lilly Ledbetter was a woman who sued for job discrimination because she found out that men were being paid more than she for the exact same thing. It was very blatant. But the Supreme Court ruled that she could not collect because she had waited too long to file the suit, because the disparity had existed for, you know, since 7 years. She pointed out that she didn't know that until a certain period, and that she had filed the lawsuit fairly promptly after she learned it. They said, tough. So that it gave people incentive then not just to pay women less, but to conceal that from them. And we did pass the law to overturn that. And that was, you know, one of the examples. So when you get the Democrats back in again, yeah, there will be efforts to strengthen the rights of unions and to talk about paid leave.
Right. This should have brought this up when we were talking about the election. What do you think about Elizabeth Warren?
That's the
big question.
You'll see her on the back of my book as one of my endorsers. She and I have had a great collaboration. If you read her book, she talks about the time she came to my apartment in Newton. So we made the agreement that we would work on the in putting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She does refer to my handsome surfer dude boyfriend, who has since become my husband, sitting in the back. She also describes the apartment, which was not lavish. She did talk about sitting with her back to the refrigerator when we talked about this. I think she's an extraordinary, important force. Historically, I do not think you have an example, probably since, sadly, Joe McCarthy, somebody, when I raised this, of a member of a junior member of Congress in the minority party who has had the influence she has had. She fortunately has a veto. I mean, the president signed a bill that the Republicans pressed him to sign that did a small rollback of the financial reform bill. It wasn't central, but it was a bad sign that they would start chipping away by putting these in appropriation bills. Nancy Pelosi sounded the alarm. Nancy and I jumped in. But Elizabeth's denunciation of that means that it's never going to happen again. So she's a very important force.
There was a draft movement. You know, there were a lot of people
who wanted
to run
for president. Yeah, and it
was very
mistaken. I had an argument with the Move On people. Because among the people who understood that was a terrible idea was Elizabeth Warren herself. I mean, she never, from the beginning, she said, people thought she'd be cute. I'm not running for president. No, and she wasn't saying, I'll see, maybe. I'm not running for president. The minute she had indicated any uncertainty on that issue, the minute she...
It was a verb tense, right? It was like, yeah. I'm not currently here.
Exactly right. I'm not currently. That's not, she would have lost a lot of her influence. Because at this point, the media correctly treats her as someone who is focused on public policy. And if in fact she even hinted she was running for the presidency, she would then be getting scrutinized, discredited, oh, that she's just saying that. In fact, Obama tried to say that himself to his discredit, I think, about the trade issue. Well, we're all trying to get votes. So I think she very correctly understood. Secondly, it would not be helpful for her to run. She would almost certainly lose the nomination. If she won the nomination in a brutal, bitter fight, she would be very unlikely. She couldn't win the presidency.
The argument, I think, was one of the arguments was that she would pull Hillary Clinton to the left.
That was Rick Santorum's argument for running against Mitt Romney, I agree. I mean, seriously, that was what happened to the Republicans in 2012. And let me put it this way. I wish I was confident that Hillary Clinton's positions, by the way, this notion that she's somehow not a liberal, if you go back to 2008, go look up Paul Krugman's columns, by far one of the best, you know, as a Nobel Prize economist, a great writer on public policy. And he was for Hillary Clinton in 2008 and documented the extent to which she was to Obama's left on domestic issues. Obviously, she made that mistake of voting for the Iraq War. So did Joe Biden. So did John Kerry. Every Democratic senator who thought he or she could be president voted for that foolish war. And I regret that, but I think that was a sign of political opportunism. And I prefer political opportunism to the wrong values, because political opportunism will change when the world changes. But I wish that Hillary Clinton's positions on the issues were so clearly popular that our job was to move her to the left. I think our job is to win where she is. And I don't understand why, on what do they want her to move to the left? On military policy, I agree, although that was not the focus of either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. In fact, when Obama signed the bill that included the rollback, the appropriations bill, Hillary Clinton tweeted that we should not be cutting things back. But again, only people who are sure that the Democratic position is overwhelmingly popular should think that our major job is to move it further to the left. You know, I'm not nearly certain enough of that for me to think we should spend a lot of time on that. And by the way, Elizabeth Warren clearly understood that herself. And that's why I debated a move on guy. And I said, I think you were. And it was also supporting her was basically saying Hillary Clinton's not far enough to the left. And I don't understand. Again, it seems to me that that argument was, let's do to ourselves what the Republicans did to themselves in 2012.
So the last question that we have time for is a question about your future. Do you plan on continuing to be a voice on Wall Street advocating for reform?
Oh, yeah. Although on other issues, well, I got to say, I did not go to Congress thinking about how to regulate derivatives. But when I went on the committee that had jurisdiction because it's the committee that deals with affordable housing, rental. My major concern was to build affordable rental housing. I've always thought, no, you don't put poor people in homes they can't afford, but let's build decent rental housing. And then I got involved with the World Bank and the IMF to try and say, no, you don't just impose this kind of rigid austerity on people. And I got into all this. I didn't know a lot about some of this stuff when it hit the fan, so I had to learn a lot about it. It's better. You know, Jim has correctly noted that he probably knows more about credit default swaps than any other surfer on the East Coast, just from, you know, sitting in and absorbing and listening to all this stuff. I will speak about that, but the number one issue, if I have only one issue to talk about, it's the importance of a substantial reduction in America's military budget and in this notion that we have to be everywhere globally, not only because it does harm in itself, but also because it deprives us of the resources we need to do those things at home that would simultaneously improve the quality of life and diminish inequality. And by that,
that's where the money, that's where your $100 billion comes
ameliorate
from.
The anti-government feelings that people, I think a lot of the white guys who vote for the most right-wing people, they're not anti-government in theory. They're disappointed that the government hasn't delivered for them the way they knew that it delivered earlier. And having the resources to do that, if I had $100 billion, I think we could persuade a lot of the guys who vote, I mean, it's white guys who vote Republican against their economic interests, we can show them why that's a mistake.
I want to ask you one yes or no question just because I'm curious. Do you think Boston should host the Olympics in 2024?
Oh, of course not. I gotta say, I was asked that question by a guy at Boston Magazine in February when I'm sitting in my home in Newton, I share with my sister when I'm not Algonquin, and you could barely get out the door because of the snow. And Boston had just gotten permission from the EPA to dump snow in the harbor. And my answer, well, my immediate answer was, we don't even have room for the snow, and the Olympics are bigger than snow. No, I was just appalled at the notion, and it does seem to be just falling apart of its own weight. I don't know people who know the social structure of Massachusetts, but the country club in Brookline, the country club, kind of like, you know, the law school means Harvard. The country club in Brookline, this exclusive first country club, apparently golf club in America, apparently learned that they had decided that the Olympic golf tournament was going to be played there without ever talking to anybody at the country club or in the town of Brookline. Just an example of stupidity. And I got to say, I was also disappointed, and I just said this, that Governor Patrick, when he was then governor, took a deal to get $7,500 a day to be the ambassador while he was still governor. That's a kind of conflict of interest. And their political judgment has been so bad, and it just doesn't make any physical sense whatsoever.
Well, that, so, no. That burning question answered. I will allow you to sell some books.
Thank you. Thank you.